This is Bill Munhausen with another episode based on Biblical Citizenship, Week 4, subtitled The Seeds of Liberty. Week 4 marks the midpoint in Patriot Academy's series on biblical citizenship, and there is always the risk of losing steam when you slog through a lot of the background information needed to build a firm foundation. This is pretty much one of those necessary works where we learn a lot about the United States Constitution so we can decide if it's worth fighting for. Please bear with it, because in Week 7 and 8 we will learn how to put all this information into action. Let me start then with a quote from a former president, one of the original leaders of the newly created United States of America. John Quincy Adams said, "The virtue which had been infused into the Constitution of the United States was no other than the concretion of those abstract principles which had first been proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence." This was the platform upon which the Constitution of the United States had been erected. Its virtues, its republican character, consisted in its conformity to the principles proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence. And as its administration was to depend upon the virtue, or in other words, of those principles proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence and embodied in the Constitution of the United States. That's quite a mouthful. In business terms, the Declaration of Independence is like the Articles of Incorporation, telling who we are and what we're about. And the Constitution is like the bylaws, telling how the business will operate. The Declaration reflects our principles and philosophy. The Constitution outlines the mechanics of how those principles are to be implemented. Samuel Adams, the father of the American Revolution, said it this way: "Before the formation of the Constitution, the Declaration was received and ratified by all the states in the Union and has never been disannulled. Even the U.S. Supreme Court once affirmed the importance of the Declaration of Independence, saying, 'The Constitution is but the body and the letter of which the former is the thought and the spirit.' And it is always safe to read the letter of the Constitution in the spirit of the Declaration of Independence." As we look at the Declaration, we can see the framers' formula for lasting freedom. It says we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. The Declaration of Independence includes four essential principles that hold our freedom firmly in place. 1. Self-evident truths, the undeniable fact that moral absolutes exist. 2. Endowed by our Creator, our unalienable right to individual freedom comes from God. 3. Consent of the governed, government is accountable to the people. And 4. The pursuit of happiness, the importance of free enterprise to our freedom. Our first president, George Washington, said, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness. The mere politician, equally with the pious man, ought to respect and to cherish them. The American Revolution was liberty with God, and it led to the most successful nation in the history of the world." The French Revolution stands in stark contrast to the American one, even though it appeared in the same era, because the French started from a different perspective. The French revolutionaries were anti-church and wanted to eradicate belief in God. The French Revolution was liberty without God, and it led to the guillotine and total chaos. The French organized their governments based on the normal model of the time. The normal model of government was based on the idea that power flowed from God to the king by divine right. The French Revolution simply replaced God with their intellectual ideas about equality. The resulting government quickly devolved into a struggle among men over who would rule the country. During the time that the United States Constitution has endured, France has implemented 14 constitutions. This is objective testimony regarding the consequences of founding a nation without God's blessing and moral standard. Benjamin Franklin was reputed to be one of the least religious of America's founders. Yet even he spoke eloquently regarding the need for prayer, saying this: "In this situation of this assembly," and he was addressing the people who were writing the Constitution, "groping as it were in the dark to find political truth, and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Light to illuminate our understandings? In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible to danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. Our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. All of us who were engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor. Have we now forgotten that powerful friend? Or do we imagine we no longer need his assistance? I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured in the sacred writing that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this. And I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessings on our deliberations be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business." The father of the Constitution, James Madison, recognized divine providence when he said, "The real wonder is that the Constitutional Convention overcame so many difficulties, and to overcome them with so much agreement was as unprecedented as it was unexpected. It is impossible for the pious man not to recognize in it a finger of that almighty hand which was so frequently extended to us in the critical stages of the Revolution." Alexander Hamilton said, "For my own part, I sincerely esteem a system which without the finger of God never could have been suggested and agreed upon by such a diversity of interests." George Washington said, "As to my sentiments with regard to the new Constitution, it appears to me little short of a miracle. It demonstrates as visibly the finger of Providence as any possible event in the course of human affairs can ever designate it." The best way to understand what the writers of the Declaration meant about the pursuit of happiness is from their own words and historical knowledge. Thomas Jefferson said, "A wise and frugal government, which shall leave men free to regulate their own pursuit of industry and improvement, shall not take from the mouth of labor bread it has earned. This is the sum of good government." William Bradford and the Pilgrims tried socialism, which Governor Bradford said caused much confusion and discontent and retarded much employment that would have been to their benefit and comfort and caused people to allege weakness and inability. In other words, they called in sick. After starving literally to death, Bradford made two very important changes by implementing private property and free enterprise. They were soon exporting corn and thriving. Governor Bradford reported, "This had very good success, for it made all hands very industrious. So much as much more corn was planted than otherwise would have been by any means the governor or any other could use, and saved him a great deal of trouble and gave far better content." John Francis Mercer clarified what the founders meant regarding the consent of the governed when he said, "It is a great mistake to suppose that the paper we are to propose will govern the United States. It is the men whom it will bring into the government and interest in maintaining it that is to govern them. The paper will only mark out the mode and the form. Men are the substance and must do the business. If we want to uphold the Constitution, we have to make wise decisions in choosing our leaders, be part of the process, and be engaged in our government. In our final class in the eighth week, we'll discuss the proper constitutional way to fulfill our duty in giving or refusing our consent. Here are six principles embedded in our founding documents. Number one, there is a divine creator. Believing in a divine creator is the first step toward limited government, because if government is all supreme, there is nothing that can impose limits. If God is not in the national equation, then government becomes God. It's a tough principle when people have lost their faith in God, but it's true nonetheless. No government will long last, or society continue, when it is based on human rule alone, because citizens quickly learn that such government is rooted in power. There is no moral high ground. Number two, our rights come from God. Every person has a set of rights given by the Creator, not by government, which government has no authority to interfere with. It might even seem like this is a formula for anarchy, because any citizen can defy the governing authority. On the contrary, this principle keeps government in check because citizens constantly remind them of the limits of their power. Number three, government exists to protect inalienable rights. Government is not there to provide for us, but to protect us while we go out and produce. The more government provides for us, the less prosperous we are, because the less initiative we have. We hear this principle expressed today whenever someone says they can't find employees, because the government pays people not to work. Principle number four, there's a fixed moral law. A lack of a fixed moral law leads to anarchy, where every person gets to decide for themselves what's right and wrong, and the powerful control the weak. John Quincy Adams called this the law of the tiger and the shark. Number five, the consent of the governed, or the will of the majority. This principle only follows the principle stating that there are inalienable rights and a fixed moral law. The consent of the governed does not overrule these basic truths. Principle number six, the people's right to change their government. Because government comes from the people, we can change our government in any way needed if the first five principles are violated. This is the principle of last resort, but it's essential to all the others. The people can change their government in an orderly way through the amendment process, or through the ultimate solution of overthrowing an out-of-control government. It's a dangerous philosophy, but it's one we have to recognize as inherently true. The sources of the ideas expressed in the Declaration of Independence were many. Richard Henry Lee said that Thomas Jefferson copied the Declaration of Independence from John Locke's book, The Two Treatises of Government, which cites the Bible over 1,500 times to show the proper operation of civil government. Historians have documented that every right set forth in the Declaration of Independence had been preached from the American pulpit prior to 1763. Many phrases in the Declaration of Independence were originally preached by Reverend John Wise, whose sermons were reprinted and published by the Founding Fathers before the Revolution. America's founders understood the concept of duty, a word that is mostly relegated to military people in our day. In George Washington's day, duty meant a legally binding contractual obligation. He said, "It is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favor." Since the Declaration is considered to be the philosophical underpinning of the U.S. Constitution, we should be able to trace the elements of the Declaration to the Constitution. The Declaration lists various grievances the colonists had with England, and we can trace those grievances as follows. The framers of the Constitution wanted to ensure they would never experience those grievances again. The fourth grievance of the Declaration says, He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual and uncomfortable and distant from the depository of their public records for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. In other words, the king was making it hard to meet with the lawmakers. The issue was addressed in Article 1, Section 5, Clause 4 of the U.S. Constitution, which prohibits either House of Congress from adjourning or changing location. The fifth grievance in the Declaration was that the king, quote, dissolved representative houses repeatedly. It was addressed in Article 1, Section 4, Clause 2, defining the meetings of Congress unless changed by law. Grievance number 7 in the Declaration was that the king was interfering with the ability of colonies to admit immigrants. It was addressed in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 4 of the Constitution by establishing a uniform rule of naturalization. Grievance number 8 had to do with the king's interference in the courts. It was addressed in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 9, where Congress was given authority to convene courts. Grievances number 11 claimed the king kept standing armies without the consent of the legislatures. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 12 gave Congress, not the president, control over the management of the military. Grievance number 12 stated he has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. This was corrected in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 14 of the Constitution, which gave Congress sole authority to raise and support armies. In a few cases, the Constitution itself did not address some of those grievances, but were addressed in the Bill of Rights, the first set of amendments to the Constitution. The colonists' 14th grievance complained about quartering troops, and the Third Amendment to the Constitution says, No soldier shall, in times of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in times of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. Similarly, grievance number 18 complained about unfair trials, and those concerns were addressed in the 6th and 7th Amendments. In order to defend your rights, you need to know what they are. That's the practical purpose of this review we're doing. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas commented, As I have traveled across the country, I have been astounded just how many of our fellow citizens feel strongly about their constitutional rights, but have no idea what they are, or for that matter, what the Constitution says. I'm not suggesting that they become constitutional scholars, whatever that means. I am suggesting, however, that if one feels strongly about his or her rights, it does make sense to know generally what the Constitution says about them. It's at least as easy to understand as a cell phone contract. Well, probably much easier to understand, and vastly more important. That brings us to a few comments about the general welfare provision of the Constitution. The preamble reads, We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. The concept of general welfare is not meant to be a loophole to allow politicians to do whatever seems good. Webster's 1828 dictionary defines general welfare to be exemption from any unusual evil or calamity, the enjoyment of peace and prosperity, or the ordinary blessings of society and civil government applied to states. General welfare is not individual welfare. It was understood to apply only to the states and the system in general. The framers of the Constitution understand that there would be need to legally and formally change the Constitution. So they crafted Article 5 to outline the process. The following are examples of amendments that were ratified through the process. The 12th Amendment, was precipitated very early on by an unanticipated problem in a presidential election. The 1800 rematch election between Adams and Jefferson created confusion when the old process created a tie in the Electoral College, not the Electrical College, between Jefferson and his running mate Aaron Burr. Due to there being no distinction between electoral votes cast for president or vice president, the tie threw the election to Congress, which finally chose Jefferson after several dozen ballots. The 12th Amendment implemented a distinction between presidential and vice presidential candidates to avoid this confusion in the future. The 22nd Amendment limited any person to serve as president to no more than two full terms, thereby curbing the power of the executive branch. This was ratified after Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected to a fourth presidential term, and the American people decided that was too long and allowed one man to have too much power. Because the District of Columbia was designed by Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 17, not to be a state or within a state, but rather a special place for the seat of the federal government, there was no provision for citizens living in D.C. to vote. The 23rd Amendment gives citizens in D.C. the right to vote for president by granting D.C. the same number of electors in the Electoral College as the smallest state. These are all examples of how our national rules can be tweaked to address the issues that come up. It was at this point that the Patriot Academy gives us a useful overview of the Constitution. It's a useful reference summary of the Constitution's content when you need to look something up. For a print version of this summary, go over to my blog at creationexpo.wordpress.com and look for it in Biblical Citizenship Week 4. The Constitution is organized into seven sections called articles, with each article addressing a particular topic. Article 1 is about Congress. Article 2 is about the President. Article 3 is about the courts. Article 4 is about the states, particularly admission of new states. Article 5 describes the amendment process. Article 6 is about debt and loyalty to the Constitution. And Article 7 describes the process of ratification. Here is a quick overview of all the amendments to the Constitution. Amendments 1 through 10 are called the Bill of Rights, which was ratified because some of the Constitution's signers were concerned that there was no specific protections for individual rights. We'll review them specifically a little later. Amendments 12, 20, 22, 23, and 25 are all about the presidency. It limited terms, it dealt with incapacitations, and etc. Amendment 11 dealt with suits against states. Amendments 17, 20, and 27 were about Congress, Senate elections, terms, and pay raises. Amendments 13, 14, and 15 ended slavery and established civil rights. The 14th Amendment further applies certain obligations to the states, not just the federal government. Amendments 15, 19, 24, and 26 addressed voting rights related to race and gender, money, and age. Amendment 16 established the income tax. Okay. The 17th Amendment changed the way the U.S. senators are elected, removing the check and balance of states' ability to curb federal encroachment upon state jurisdictions. Amendments 18 and 21 illustrate the power of amendments. Americans decided to ban consumption of alcohol, but rather quickly experienced unintended consequences. The 18th Amendment was necessary for Congress to ban alcohol because the people had never given them, through the Constitution, authority to do so. The amendment process is responsive enough that they reversed course with Amendment 21 to reverse their mistake. Let's go back to a quick summary of the Bill of Rights, the original 10 amendments. The First Amendment secured freedom of religion, speech, the press, peaceful assembly, and petitioning the government. All fundamental rights of conscience, freedom of thought. They're kind of like they're the First Amendment for a reason, because they're kind of the primary things that government is intended to protect. The Second Amendment guarantees the right to bear arms. The Third Amendment protects citizens from being forced to quarter soldiers. The Fourth Amendment protects us from unlawful searches and seizures. The Fifth Amendment protects the rights of people accused of crimes, including grand juries for important crimes, prohibition of being tried twice, freedom from self-incrimination, due process and protections regarding seizure of private property for public use. The Sixth Amendment guarantees speedy public jury trial, confronting witnesses, and access to an attorney. The Seventh Amendment provides rules for civil trials as opposed to criminal trials. The Eighth Amendment prohibits excessive fines, bail, and cruel and unusual punishment. The Ninth Amendment makes it clear that citizens have rights beyond the ones listed in the Constitution. The Tenth Amendment distinguishes between federal and state authority. Federal powers are limited to those enumerated in the Constitution. All other authority is left to the states or to the people. So there you have it, an overview of the United States Constitution, its philosophical roots in the Declaration of Independence, and an outline of its content as a quick reference to research any specific concern. Thanks for joining us today. Until next time, go out and do good.